So this week's sutta class is on the Majjhima 102, the Panchatthaya Sutta. And the Panchatthaya Sutta is a very interesting, quite difficult sutta, which is discussion of systematic discussion of various kinds of views and attachments to views. And of course this topic is a very important topic in Buddhism because it revolves around the idea of the identification with the self, and is mentioned countless times in different places, but this is one of the more complex and systematic approaches to that. So it's one of the earliest texts in any kind of literature that really discusses these kinds of quite profound philosophical issues in such a systematic manner. The text is a bit difficult, both because of the subject matter is quite profound, but also because there's a variety of textual problems with the sutta as we have it. And these problems, at least some of the problems, are found not just in the Pali version, but also in the other versions as well. So it's not a simple matter to resolve them. The text has a number of counterparts, which we have here. Two sets of counterparts. One here from the Dirghagama of the Sarvastivadin, so a number of fragments there. And also a number of fragments from Terfang, published by Sandra Goldschmidt. These also probably Sarvastivadin, or more likely Mula Sarvastivada provenance. And also there's a Tibetan version as well, which is, of course, Mula Sarvastivada. Not of course, but that is probably Mula Sarvastivada. And this one was edited and discussed in Peter Skilling's volumes, the Mahasutras. And here I have the one of the volumes here. We have the first, this is a series he did in three volumes. And the word Mahasutras in this context is actually a collection or group of sutras in the Tibetan canon, which are usually more or less sort of considered together, part of the same group of texts, and which are early Agama sutras. So this, and in fact they are the main body of Agama sutras in the Tibetan canon. So the Tibetan, unlike the Chinese, doesn't have any full Agamas, and doesn't have any very there's a lot of Agama material here and there, but it doesn't have any large collections of Agamas, but it does have this one, as well as various other things in various other places. It has this one group called the Mahasutras, which has a number of sutras which are familiar from the Pali canon. Some of them are Paritta-style texts, the Dajagga Sutta, which is from the Sagatawagga of the Sanyutta Nikaya, the Atanatiya Sutta, which is a Paritta from the Digha Nikaya, and various other suttas, some of which are not found in Pali, and one of them, of course, being the Panchatthaya Sutta. So Peter Skilling has done a three-volume set on these with text, detailed analysis and translation, and we have, I think, the first two volumes. So if anybody wants to have a look at that, then that's really worthwhile. The third volume hadn't been published when I looked at it last, but we should have a look again and see whether it's been published. Some of you may remember Peter Skilling, he visited here last year. Yeah, so this is recently, yes, the year before last. And he's an excellent scholar. He lives in Bangkok and works out of Bangkok, but works one of the few scholars working today with all of the texts from all the traditions.
Is that particular collection used by the defenders?
He discusses all of that stuff in there. It was basically, it seems, I'm not sure whether it is used today, I can't remember now, but it was used as a basically seems to have been a Purita-style collection. So its main purpose for recitation, like a small collection for recitation. Most of them, or a lot of them, are used for that purpose in the Pali collection as well. Some of them not, Panchatara is not. So we'll be, as usual, relying as much as we can on Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation and also looking at Venerable Amalia's essay. I won't go in detail through Peter Skilling's work here, it's a bit too detailed for a class like this. And we'll also be paying special attention to Bhikkhu Bodhi's notes. He has quite a number of notes which are quite important for this. Thus have I heard, on one occasion, the Blessed One was staying at Savatthi in Jetis Grove and Anuttapindika's park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir," they replied, "the Blessed One said this, bhikkhus, there are some recluses and Brahmins who speculate about the future and hold views about the future who assert various doctrinal propositions concerning the future." So this is a kind of classification which is also shared in common with the... do you want to close the thingy? Thanks, Anna. This is a kind of doctrinal way of categorising which is shared in common with the Brahmajana Sutta, the first sutta in the Digha Nikaya. Of course, there are many, many points of parallel between this sutta and the Digha, and one being that they classify views about the concerned with those with the past and those with the future. Now, both the Brahmajala and even more so the Panchatthaya have certain classification problems, which we will have a look at in a little bit more detail. But nevertheless, the basic idea is straightforward enough, which is that if the idea of holding views about the future is the idea that you're holding views about what's going to happen to myself in the future. Okay, so the five views that's mentioned here. The self is percipient and unimpaired after death. That's the first one. Second one, some assert that the self is non-percipient and unimpaired after death. Some assert thus the self is neither percipient nor non-percipient and unimpaired after death. Or they describe the annihilation, destruction and extermination of an existing being at death. Or number five, some assert nibbana here and now. Okay, so the idea... interesting to note that all of the ones that assert the existence of a self after death, what they have in common is that they assert that the self is unimpaired after death. Yeah? The word for unimpaired is arogya. Isn't the Pali good enough for you? Arogo, literally arogo, roga means illness. Okay, so it means not ill, not sick after death. Okay, so that's the word that's actually translated as unimpaired, is healthy after death. So they're all basically giving, they're all basically saying things are going to be better after we die, right? That's the basic point that they're all making in their different ways, yeah? And so of course, this is sort of giving kind of the basic psychology of this. Why do we want to develop theories of the afterlife? Well, because we're a bit afraid of it, right? And because we're kind of suffering now, we want that suffering to be over, and we like to imagine that things are going to be better in the future. So you kind of develop this idea of the self being healthy after death. The problem is, of course, that once you try to specify in more detail what you actually mean by saying that things are going to be okay after you die, then you start to run into problems. And that's why, as we can see further down, that all of the people who hold these different kind of views, they all criticize each other, because they all are not satisfied with each other's descriptions of what healthy or what arogya or aroga actually means. Percipient means it has perception, and the word here is Pali sanya. Okay, so sanyi abdahoti, so the self has sanya, is the third of the five khandhas. Okay, so this is saying it has sanya. In a general sense, to say it has sanya means that simply that it's aware, it's conscious after death. But it's also important to note that the self, the nature of the self, is being described in terms of one or other of the five khandhas, in this case, the sanya khanda. Okay, so it has both sanya, or does it not have sanya, or does it have both sanya and not have sanya? Okay, so that's the classification system that's being used here. So the idea of a self after death is defined in terms of sanya. So this is one of the reasons why I think that the very idea of the five khandhas, the five aggregates, was like an assemblage of the different kinds of things, different kinds of ways that people identify with the self. So in this case, they're identifying with sanyi. In the Brahmajala Sutra itself, there's others, they say rupi atta, self is, has form. Actually, I think that's a bit later on, it has the self as form. Is that this one? Anyway, we'll find out. Okay, so that's, in brief, some are certainly Bana here and now. That's a difficult one on a number of levels. It's also difficult in the Brahmajala, what it actually means. And it's not even clear whether it's meant to be a good thing or a bad thing. Okay, so it can be interpreted as a in the Brahmajala it seems to be meaning a kind of delusory false nibbana. So people either identify sensual happiness as nibbana here and now, or the four jhanas as nibbana here and now. But here the place of it is a bit peculiar, and it's also a bit peculiar why it's classified under doctrinal propositions about the future, because obviously it's talking about here and now. So we'll have a bit of a look at that later, and the various scholars who've looked at it have all discussed this particular problem. It seems, just to put it from the beginning, it seems that the text has suffered fairly large-scale corruption, and especially structural corruption. Bits and pieces of it are in places where they shouldn't be. Yeah, we'll have a bit look at that later on. Venerable Anālaya tries to reconstruct the original text. Okay, so that's the five propositions. Then the text goes on to then synthesize that to then three forms of proposition. Either you describe an existing self that's unimpaired after death, so that's the first three, or the destruction and extermination of an existing being at death, that's number four, or you assert nibbana here and now, that thus these views being five become three, and being three become five. This is the summary of the five and three. Okay, so that's of course the title of the sutta, although Anālaya suggests that that's actually not meant to be the original title of the sutta as a whole. One of the questions is whether this idea of the five and three is meant to apply to the whole sutta, or whether to just the views about the future.
Does that refer to
the...
And what is it referring to? A self.
The self, the atta, yeah.
It's not referring to a body or a rupa, is it just the sanya?
In this case, it can be the body, it can be the sanya. This one is not necessarily saying that the self either has a body or not, doesn't have a body, doesn't take a stand on that particular point. So it could be saying that, for example, the first one, the self is percipient after death and healthy, okay? And it could be a physical percipient self, yeah? Or it could be an immaterial percipient self and so on. So it could be then further described in different ways.
So there's no inner part, there's no indication that the unimpairedness, mm-hmm, relates to any particular part of the self.
That's right, yeah. That's right. The unimpairedness is not a particular characteristic of the self, but it refers to the whatever there is as a whole is healthy, it's good. Yeah?
Yep. This is a really good view.
Yep.
It would be dark.
Absence of roga, yeah.
Free of affliction.
Free of affliction, exactly, yeah. Yeah, yeah, these words for health and affliction seem to have had a somewhat more pregnant meaning than they do for us. We wouldn't quite say healthy. We might say whole or something. Not sure what we'd say. Perfected or something, I'm not sure. But they, yeah. That's in a number of cases we find that. Yeah, aroga is a similar synonym or term for nibbana as well.
So free of affliction.
Free of affliction, yeah. Nibbana. So there, unfortunately, Bhikkhu Bodhi's on the screen is running out. So I'll have to read the next bit with the somewhat less good translation on the screen. There isn't one by Venerable Tanisio either. So. Okay, so it then goes on to say those recluses and Brahmins who describe the self as percipient and unimpaired after death describe such a self to be either, and then goes on to a list of different forms of self that can be percipient and unimpaired. It's material, immaterial, both material and immaterial, neither material nor material, the first four, or percipient of unity, percipient of diversity, percipient of the limited, or percipient of the immeasurable. Or else, among those few who go beyond this, some make assertions about the consciousness kasina, immeasurable and imperturbable. Okay, so this is a somewhat obscure phrase. So we'll go through each one of these. So we have the rupi. So this is what we're talking about, the self which has form. A rupi, rupincha a rupincha, neva ruping na ruping. Okay, so that's the first four. So you can have a self which has a form. And is percipient. Now that form, we translate material in Pali or in Indic idiom, doesn't just mean a sort of clunky physical body like we have, but also the divine bodies that the devas have are also rupi, yeah, manomaya kaya. So it also includes the various kinds of subtle form. And in fact would even include the realms of the Brahmas. Okay, so the four Brahma realms, also rupi, yeah, of course, because they're generated by the rupa jhanas. So that would encompass, that's certainly most of the realms of existence are both material and percipient. Okay, otherwise you could be arupi and sanyi, so the self, it could be formless and percipient, of course that referring to the formless realms, the four formless realms. Rupincha, arupincha, both formed and formless. The self can be percipient and both form and formless. What does that mean?
You can choose.
You can choose one or the other?
Yeah.
Wouldn't you be either rupi or arupi?
Yes, you can make from either.
Yeah. But if you're a rogo, I can understand that. But if you're really a rogo, then you wouldn't be getting bored. Boredom is surely an affliction. So what does rupincha arupincha mean?
Maybe when you meditate, you're in a sort of formless. That's the other part of you that's formless.
Yeah, possibly.
Maybe the father is a rupee and the mother is a rupee.
Mom is a rupee and father's a rupee. Maybe rupee here means cash. Yeah, maybe you've got rupees some days, and then other days you haven't got any rupees. So. Yeah, it's a bit, it's not entirely obvious to me what that means altogether, but I think these kinds of, when it says rupincha arupincha, when it has this kind of phrasing, what it's usually meaning is something that can be considered in some ways to be like this, and in other respects to be like that. So a self which is percipient and which in some respects has a form and in some respects is formless. Yeah? Something like that? I think is probably the kind of thing that it means. Possibly. There's maybe some conception like that where there's these like different aspects. Yeah. Both form and formless.
Could be substances of like kind of what I want, like formless form. What about the kind of people?
These are supposed to be views held by people who still have delusion. Yeah, so it's quite possible that it's an expression which doesn't actually mean anything. Right, that's certainly possible. But as I said, as an idiom, see, in terms of an idiom, this is kind of fourfold logic. It's plus minus, both plus and minus, neither plus nor minus. And so that's a very common logic. It's not meant to be paradoxical in a sense. It's meant to express the fact that the world's more complicated than just black and white opposites. Yeah. It's a formula which is used in many cases. So an obvious example, an easier example to explain, which is used in the Brahmajala Sutta, would be say that the self is percipient and happy. Is percipient and unhappy, is percipient and both happy and unhappy, and is percipient and neither happy nor unhappy. So in that case, it's pretty easy to understand, isn't it? So if you're percipient and happy after death, that means you go to a nice heaven realm and you enjoy yourself playing the harp and dancing around with the fairies. Percipient and unhappy means you do the same thing and you have musical taste, in which case you just hate harp music after about 1,000 years, okay? So you'd be unhappy. The third one, meaning you'd be sometimes happy and sometimes unhappy, which means you'd be unhappy with all the harp music, but then eventually Tom Waits will come to heaven and sing with the harp, and then you'll be happier. Okay? So that's easy to understand how you know, you're like even in this realm, you know, you say, is this realm happy? You say, well, it's both happy and unhappy. Yeah?
This is just a straight point. It's it doesn't to be either, and then there's a list of ors. So if you only can choose one of those, surely, from that list. You know,
yeah.
Logic is,
yes, yeah.
Boolean logic terms.
Yeah.
You have material or
immaterial
or
material and immaterial.
Put parentheses around that, all material and immaterial. You can't have material and percipient.
Why not?
Because the way it's presented here.
But they're all say that.
Or doesn't it, mean or but, and or and all.
No, but they all say that they're percipient.
No, they don't.
Yes, they do. Yeah. And actually Bhikkhu Bodhi's abbreviated by putting that in the beginning, that actually in the Pali text in front of you, which you can see, each view says rupi, this samana brahma declare this self to be percipient and form
for each
individual one. Yeah. Okay. Sorry, Sita.
The last one
we'll get to in a minute. But so both percipient. I think what it probably means is something. Probably means it's something simpler than we might imagine it to mean. I suspect it just means that that this person doesn't identify the self exclusively with either physical or immaterial things, but identifies the self with both of them. So if, even in the human realm, you could say myself is both material and immaterial, because myself is my body, and myself is also my consciousness, or myself is my feelings. Yeah? Myself is both of those things. And so that's what rupi and arupi means. Whereas in the previous cases, for example, the first one, if the self is born percipient and possessing form, then he's identifying the self with what is possessing form, even though there might be other things happening there, but that's what he's actually identifying it with. Does that make sense? Because when you identify with itself, you don't necessarily identify with everything, you identify with one thing. But you might identify with more than one thing. Eh? I might say myself is all of these things.
Maybe just let Maharupa just identifying with the Rupa side.
Yeah, that's right. That someone might identify with both Nama and Rupa. Yeah? So again, the question isn't whether it's a reasonable view, but the question is obviously what some people do. So, okay, and then the last one, never rūpiṃ na rūpiṃ. Oh, just to come back to that idea of rūpiṃcha arūpiṃcha, is actually not uncommon these days. It's probably the Muslim view of the self, I would think, is that it's both form and formless, and also for many Christians. Christian view of self is not actually very well articulated. It was hardly at all articulated in the Bible or anything like that. And sometimes they have a self which sort of seems to be more of a completely immaterial, eternal soul. But very often there's actually more of a physical dimension. So there's more of a sense of like a whole person. And certainly that's the case for the Muslims. That's why they're buried rather than cremated, so that when they kind of go up to heaven or resurrected, they have their body with them.
Well, so it's more. My body was coming with me, and
right. Okay. So that would be rūpiṃcha arūpiṃcha.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I thought you'd get a much better body. Well, yes. All of your imperfections are destroyed. Yeah. I mean, that's beautiful.
So it's probably something like that is what this one is.
That's at the end of the world.
That's when the rapture happens, yeah. Okay, never rūpiṃ na rūpiṃ, neither possessing form nor formless. And then whereas the both A plus B formulation usually means something that encompasses these different aspects. And what the neither A nor B kind of thing, kind of formulation, expresses some kind of in-between or subtle state which can't be properly characterized as either of those two things. So again, it's not meant to be a paradox as such, but it's meant to say, well, there are these subtle things which can't fit neatly into those categories. And it doesn't have to be a paradox at all. You could say, is twilight day or night? You say, well, it's neither day nor night. Yeah, it's actually an in-between state which has parts of both, but you can't really say is either day or night. So that's usually the kind of thing that it says when it talks about neva rupi na rupi. And can anyone think of any examples that might come to mind for a kind of theory of a self or a soul that fits that?
Well, if you walk into the giant of the mysterious giant, but the self is totally your nose.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like you walk into that tired, carrying mind, it seems it's a sort of neither form nor self.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. The form of formless. Okay, so in the next one gives a number of different another four kinds of self. Here is no longer distinguished by whether they have form or not, but by distinguished by the kind of sanya that they have. Okay. First one is ekatta sanya, is a percipient of unity. Okay, so that would be especially those kinds of perception which are determined by samadhi attainments. Yeah, perception of unification. Nanatta sanya, perception of diversity, such as the human realm and animal realm and so on, which are very diverse and very diverse kinds of perception. Paritta sanya, limited perception, again all of the lower realms would be considered as having limited perception, and the apamana sanyi would be those again developed from a high samadhi attainment, perhaps from the Brahma viharas, which are the apamanas, or perhaps any of the higher samadhi attainments would be considered as measureless perception. Okay, so then there are some who go beyond that, and they declare the vijnana kasina, which is measureless. That's the same word as we have here. Again, this is one of the things that's showing us is the word measureless is referring to samadhi attainments. The vijnana kasina, the consciousness kasina, which is measureless and imperturbable. So the word imperturbable is usually used for the fourth jhana or above. And so here, the vijnana kasina, as always in the suttas, and we discussed this a few weeks ago, doesn't refer to an object of meditation, but to an attainment of meditation. And the word kasina is best translated as totality or universal, something like that. So the consciousness totality or the consciousness universal. Now, in other places where we have lists, you have the four, you sometimes have lists of the four elements, and then the space kasina, and then the vijnana kasina. Okay, the fifth and sixth being the space kasina and vijnana kasina. And in those cases, it looks very much like the four element kasinas are really referring to the four jhanas. The space kasina is referring to the base of infinite space, and the vijnana kasina is referring to the base of infinite consciousness. And I think that's in fact precisely what they are referring to. And I think the word vijnana kasina is in fact a synonym for the base of infinite consciousness, which is what the sub-commentary in this case actually says. Imperturbable. It means it's not. Perturbable. It's not disturbed or shaken or. But it has a very subtle. The word like perturb has a very kind of subtle thing. But the idea is it's not moved at all by the pleasant feeling. Like the first three jhanas have that pleasant feeling, which has still got an attractive force on the mind. So in the fourth jhana, it's completely neutral feeling. So this is why it's called imperturbable. So it's even more stable because it doesn't have the pleasant feeling. Yeah, it's one of the phrases in the stock phrase on the fourth jhana where it says that who's attained to that state of mind which is brilliant, purified, attained to imperturbability, and so on and so forth, and then goes on to develop the various psychic powers. Yeah. Okay, so the vijnana kasina. What do we have here? So do you want to look at that? Sorry. Okay. So this the Tathagata understands abhijanati. Those good Samanas and Brahmanas who describe the self as percipient and healthy after death, and describe such a self to be either material or immaterial and so on and so forth, or else some make assertions about the base of nothingness, or else some make assertions about the base of nothingness immeasurable and imperturbable. For them, there is nothing is declared to be the purest, supreme, best, and unsurpassed of those perceptions, whether perceptions of form or formless, of unity or diversity. That is conditioned and gross, but there is the cessation of activities, cessation of sankharas, having known there is this, seeing the escape from that, the Tathagata has gone beyond this. And this paragraph here is again similar, but not identical with the refrain in the Brahmajala Sutta, where the Buddha sums up each verse there. And again, the Brahmajala Sutta is a little bit more coherent. But just to have a look at that last paragraph. So again, why the base of nothingness is brought in here specifically? Because there's obviously a sequence going on, because the base of nothingness obviously surmounts the base of infinite consciousness, which we've referred to before. But still, why it comes here at the end of the refrain rather than in the body of the text discussing the various views is a bit unclear. Okay, so there are those who declare the base of nothingness to be to be purified, supreme, the peak, unexcelled, and they declare it in that way, whether of form or formless or unity or diversity. Okay, so some declare like that, and presumably, for example, that would be say Alarika Lama, the Buddha's first teacher, who taught the base of nothingness. And now that is, and here comes the Buddha's critique of all of these views, that even that most refined and perfected of all views is still conditioned and coarse, or larikam. But there is the cessation, nirodha, of sankharas. Okay, so the cessation of all activities. Having known that, the Tathagata sees the escape from all of those. So, and here, one thing to bear in mind, it's not necessarily obvious from the text, and especially from the way that we think about these things in English idiom, is what it means here by sankhara nirodha. Now, of course, when we hear about sankhara nirodha, we should immediately think about dependent origination, right? And in fact, in the Brahmajala, again, dependent origination is actually brought in more explicitly. And what does dependent origination do? What does sankhara do in dependent origination? Well, sankhara is the condition for consciousness, and in particular for the consciousness which is the rebirth consciousness. So it's sankhara which is the actual condition for all of these forms of rebirth. What he's talking about is these kinds of ways that a self can be happy in the future, and which you can condition the self to be in one of these states in the future. But there is the sankhara nirodha, so through the ending of sankhara there's the ending of consciousness, and so the ending of all of these kinds of self being reborn in the future. Okay, and that also relates to this teaching on the base of nothingness. And of course, when Alarika Lama taught that, what he was teaching was the rebirth in the base of nothingness. Yeah, again, being a sankhara, a condition, a force in the mind, which is still propelling consciousness onto rebirth in one state or another. But there is the cessation of that. So this is, of course, why the Bodhisattva was dissatisfied with that teaching, because it wasn't teaching about the cessation of that sankhara. Okay, is that clear enough? Any questions before we go on? It's just going to get worse. All right. Next. Therein, bhikkhus, those recluses and Brahmins who describe the self as non-percipient and unimpaired describe such a self, non-percipient and unimpaired after death, to be either material, immaterial, both material and immaterial, or neither material nor immaterial. Okay, so we now have the non-percipient and unimpaired self. Okay, so the asanyi atta. So, because compared to the previous list where we had the eight forms of the self, this time we have to drop out the last four, because the last four are all talking about the kinds of sanya that the self has after death. So for this next group we can't have those four, because the self is non-percipient, there's no sanya, so they go, and we just have the first four: material, immaterial, material and immaterial, neither material nor immaterial. So, so again, to just what these kind of mean in this context, again, is not entirely clear. Here we go. Okay, so a self which has form and is impercipient after death. Okay, so that's straightforward enough. You get reborn as a brick or something like that. Yeah. So you're just purely in some kind of physical thing. Yeah, but it's still healthy.
A healthy fruit. A blob.
You're non-percipient and formless. It's a bit harder to. The rest of them is a bit obscure. What's a non-percipient and formless self? Yeah. Sorry.
Neither.
No, that's still a form. That's still a form. Perhaps you get space. Yeah. You get reborn as space. Just a suggestion. I don't know. You get reborn as both formed and formless. Part of you is a brick, and part of you is, it's like a brick with holes in it, or a Swiss cheese. You're reborn as a Swiss cheese. You have. Yeah, and it's a nice Swiss cheese. It's a healthy Swiss cheese with holes in it.
It could be a lion.
A lion?
A lion.
Yeah.
You could be a direction. You could be a mind wandering around. Yeah.
But if you're mind, then you're sunny. Oh. Yeah, you can't have perception.
You can't have perception. Alright, could be a dot.
Yeah, I mean, normally, of course, perception and feeling always go together.
Right.
Yeah, but. Yeah.
I think it's a brick.
Brick with holes. And then there's the neither form nor formless and without perception. So it's a bit unclear, and it's a little bit controversial about whether all of these theories actually apply to existing philosophical schools. And certainly there's no doubt that these are the kinds of views which the ancient Indian samanas and brahmanas had and debated, and there's plenty of evidence for that. But when we look at some of the details, it's a bit hard to think of examples of all of them. Some scholars who've examined it, I think Jayatilaka comes to the conclusion that the 62 views in the Brahmajala do in fact represent existing schools, but others think that, although some of them may do, in some cases it's purely hypothetical. Yeah? But, you know, having said which, there's certainly a strong tendency in the Indian thought to sort of get into these systematic presentations. So you can well imagine that this would be a subject for debate, you know, trying to imagine we have a self. We all agree that we have a self. We all agree that the self will survive after death and is healthy, but we're not quite sure exactly what that means. And so we kind of debate that and then end up classifying it and looking at the advantages and disadvantages of the different conceptions.
Can you speak to the space of birth with Guruja Pramanana?
That's right, yeah, the Asanya Sata.
Second example, the first one.
That would be the first one, yeah.
You took away Rupa, for example, of the next one.
Sorry?
You took away Rupa from that first.
Uh-huh.
For example, of the next one.
Yeah.
It
would be. It would be, yes, but.
No, it's like totally paused.
Yeah, what's
no,
the place where the brick was when you take it away.
Very good.
Yeah, Arupi Asanyi. Okay, so then therein, because these criticize those recluses and Brahmins who describe the self as percipient and unimpaired after death. Okay, so this mob is criticizing the first mob. Why is that? Because they say perception is a disease, sanya rogo. So this is a bit unfortunate. The Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation obscures the connection here. But this is obviously the same roga as we've had before. So they're saying we can't have sanya, we can't have perception, because sanya itself is a disease. Sanya is a tumor. Sanya is a dart or an arrow. And this is peaceful, etang santang, etang panitang, yadidang asanyanti. So this phrase, etang santang, this is peaceful, etang panitang, this is refined, that phrase is in Buddhism, of course, used for nibbana. And so that's what they consider to be peaceful is asanya.
So that unimpaired precludes perception.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, and in fact, you know, the Buddhist point of view would be the same. They say that you know, plenty of times in the Khanda Samyutta it talks about the five khandas in exactly these same forms. Yeah, so you can see what's meaning there when you see that. In the Khanda Samyutta it talks about these things as being a disease, a dart, an affliction, and so on. But this is what it's referring to. But what they're still holding on to, of course, is the idea of a form self, or neither form or whatever, but still holding on to the idea of yourself in some form, some way.
It's curious that they go into all of these different material, neither nor, and all this.
Yeah.
But they sort of, without question, the self is unimpaired after death for me. There's no, like, that's just a given.
Yeah. Right, and then the rest of it doesn't really matter, does it?
Well,
if you know that the self is going to be healthy, then oh god, the rest
of it.
Seems
like it's very comforting to think that, yeah, it's nice to put a healthy, something that you can work with after.
Yeah, yeah.
Something to sort of identify with.
Yeah, and I think the problem here is that perhaps because of a confusion in the phrasing, but what these guys are, it seems like, it's unclear from the text, but what it sounds like is that they're talking about what happens to anybody after they die. Right, but what I think it's actually talking about is their conception of what is what is the ultimate spiritual goal. Yeah, so this is why this use of the phrase etang santang etang panitang, this is peaceful, this is refined, is used in Buddhism for the goal for nibbana. So in other words, if it's interpreted in that way, then it's not saying that everybody's self after death is going to be in one of, or other of these ways, but it's saying that if you practice properly, yeah, whatever their conception of practice is, that you will end up with a self which is like that, and this is the goal of our spiritual practice. Yeah? So that makes sense in terms of, you know, it's why it's including all of these jhana attainments and various other kinds of things. So, and perhaps what they would then say is that what is realized at the end of that practice is actually your true self. Whereas for most people, what gets reborn is not their actual true self. Yeah? Yeah, and that's still the deluded self, the small self. Okay. The Tathagata understands this thus. Those good recluses and Brahmins who describe the self as non-percipient and unimpaired after death describe such a self to be either material or immaterial, or neither material nor immaterial, that any recluse and Brahmin could say, okay, this is now the Buddha's point of view, that anyone could say, apart from feeling, apart from form, apart from feeling, apart from perception, apart from sankharas, I will describe the coming or the going or the falling away or the re-arising or the growth or the increase or the fulfillment of consciousness that is not possible. That is conditioned and gross, but there is the cessation of activities. Having known there is this, seeing the escape from that, the Tathagata has gone beyond that. Nisarana dasavi. Okay, so here the Buddha brings in specifically the five khandhas, yeah? Form, feeling, perception, sankharas, and says that apart from these four initial khandhas, and notice that the self so far has been always described in terms of these four, especially the rupa and sanya, apart from that we can't describe the coming and going of consciousness. And the words here for coming and going are all words which basically mean the rebirth. Okay, so the agating, the gutting, gati being mean rebirth. Chuti is a word for death or passing away. Upapati is a normal word for rebirth. Wudhing, viruling, vepulang, these are words that are used to describe in the Nidana Samyutta, in the context of dependent origination. They're used regularly to describe consciousness which is planted, patitita, in a new rebirth, and which then grows, develops, matures in that birth, as, say, through the development of a child, the infant in the womb, growing up, and so on. So this is talking about the developmental process that happens to a person in their life, the growth of their development of their consciousness. So you can't talk about rebirth without... you can't talk about the rebirth of consciousness without these other four factors. In other words, what the Buddha is saying here is that you can't have a kind of consciousness which is divorced from these other four things. You can't have a consciousness which exists somehow independent of these other four khandhas. And this, of course, being one of the major contributions that the Buddha made to Indian philosophy, because in the Upanishads, that's precisely what they do talk about, is the idea of a consciousness which is in some way aloof from all of those other things. So the Buddha is showing that all of these things are conditioned. So consciousness again is conditioned. And so here again the context of dependent origination is implied throughout all the terminology. Okay, that's conditioned. So again that's the sankhara which is giving rise to the vijnana. In accordance with dependent origination, and that is coarse, but there is also the cessation of activities, the cessation of sankharas or cessation of karma, which of course is the escape and is nibbana. Let's see if we've got bigger bodies. Where do we have bigger bodies? Book back. 8:41. Okay. So the next group is those who describe a self as neither percipient nor non-percipient and unimpaired after death. And they describe such a self, neither percipient nor non-percipient and unimpaired, aroga, to be either material or immaterial, or both material and immaterial, or neither material nor immaterial. So normally, of course, when we're talking about neither perception nor non-perception, then immediately we think about the fourth of the formless attainments, they said neither perception nor non-perception. Here, however, obviously it can't mean just that, because it also describes itself as rupi, whereas, of course, in Buddhism, that neither perception nor non-perception is arupi. So that would fit into the rebirth in that plane, would fit into the second category here, neither perception nor non-perception, and immaterial, but wouldn't fit into the other three. And again, it being a bit obscure exactly what is meant by those other kinds of rebirth, neither percipient nor non-percipient, and neither material nor immaterial. Sounds a bit like somebody has got a bit problems with making decisions about what they think. But you see how this is how philosophy works, you know, and you can see, look, if you look at the history of all of these doctrines of self and soul and the God and rebirth and all of those things, they all work in this exactly the same way, yeah? And you know, it's very important to understand this pattern. They all start out with some kind of simple idea, yeah? They say, oh, I'm going to survive after death, yeah? And then, well, what's going to survive? Well, I'm going to survive. This body here is going to survive. And then somebody comes along and says, but does that mean that you're going to get old? Does that mean that you're going to, you know, is it going to be the same body you have? Oh, no. It's actually going to be a subtle body that's going to survive. I'm not going to be, you know, wrinkly and decrepit and having a bad back and having hay fever and so on for the next million years in eternity. But actually, I'm going to have a perfect body. So it becomes more and more subtle. But then is even that perfect body, is that going to be okay? And you can then criticize that. So you say, well, it's not actually a physical body at all. It's really just a body of perception and so on. And so there's always this dialectic process that you see in religions and in metaphysics, where it will move from a relatively coarse, relatively common sense notion of the self, and then as the discussion and the philosophers go on and on, it becomes more and more abstract and subtle until eventually it kind of disappears off into this realm that you can't really make sense of. Yeah? And so you start talking about it in these very kind of abstract terms, which are more just kind of evocative of a response to the idea, but they don't actually mean anything very much. Okay, so then this mob then criticizes, this is the neither perception nor non-perception mob, criticizes the other mobs, and they say, they criticize Patikosanti, the other mob, and they say that sanya, right, so their criticism here is sanya rogo, sanya gando, sanya salang. So sanya is a disease, a tumor, and a das. So in that case, they would agree with the second mob, but then they would disagree with them by saying that asanya, non-percipients, samoho. Right? Normally, samoho is moho is confusion. Yeah. So asanya is samoho. In other words, it's stupidity. Right? You don't know anything. You haven't got any perception. So they say this is peaceful and this is refined, neither perception nor non-perception. So you can see this dialectic process of continual criticism of the previous ideas and always coming to a more subtle or refined formulation of the presentation. So then the Tathagata goes on to then the Buddha's refrain, the Tathagata understands this, Those good recluses and Brahmins who describe the self as neither percipient nor non-percipient and unimpaired after death describe such a self to be either material, non-material, both material and non-material, or neither material nor immaterial. If any recluses and Brahmins describe the entering upon this base to come about through a measure of formations regarding what is seen, heard, sensed, and cognized, that is declared to be a disaster for entering upon this base. For this base, it is declared, is not to be attained as an attainment with formations. This base, it is declared, is to be attained as an attainment with a residue of formations. That is conditioned and gross, but there is cessation of formations. Having known there is this thing, the escape from that, the Tathagata has gone beyond that. So this is a somewhat obscure passage. I hope you agree. But it actually makes perfect sense. I'm just trying to find the Pali. Okay. But it's kind of obscured a bit by the translation, but the actual idioms are straightforward here, because those Samanas and Brahmins who declare an entry upon this base, so the word for base is ayatana, and the entry is upasampada. Okay, so the same word used for ordination is upasampada, and of course is a standard word that's used for entering into a samadhi attainment, yeah? So the first jhana, upasampaja viharati, one enters and abides in the first jhana, is the same word here, okay? So it's upasampada. So they describe the entry upon this base, in other words, the attainment of this state. Yeah, but ayatana also having the sense of a place of rebirth. Okay, or it could be just the meditation attainment itself. So it's saying, okay, so anybody who declares that getting into this attainment, so instead of saying entering upon this base, let's say getting into this attainment, okay? In other words, anyone who says that you can get into the base of neither perception nor non-perception, or the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception, and you still have sankhara matta, okay? So you still have an activity. Matta is, sankhara is activity, volition, intention. Matta is in this case means like a leftover or residue of what is seen, what is heard, what is thought. Mutta is what is thought, or vinyatava is what is cognized. Okay, so if you reckon that you can get into the base of neither perception with any of these kinds of activities regarding sense activity, thoughts, and things that you've cognized, then you're a fool, okay? That's a disaster. You can't get into that attainment, okay? So that attainment is something, that samapatti, that attainment is something which can only be attained with a sankharavasesa, okay? With a sankhara which is left over or residual. So the point here is that again, just to rephrase this all in everyday English from the beginning, if you want to get into the base of neither perception nor non-perception, then you can't do that if you still have intentions and volitions regarding things that you've seen, heard, thought about, or cognized, because the base of neither perception nor non-perception is something which is very subtle and can only be attained when there is with a sankhara or a volition which is left over. And this is, in other words, means that you have the, before you meditate, you have the volition or you have the sankhara, you have the thought in your mind, I'm going to do this meditation, I'm going to get into this base of neither perception nor non-perception, okay? But when you're actually meditating, you let that sankhara go. You're not thinking during the meditation itself, I want to get into this base, I want to get into this attainment. Yeah? But the mind is still following along that track, which is directed by the previous sankhara. Okay? So that's why it's called a sankhara vasesa. It's the remnant or the residue of your previous intention. So it's not saying, so it's different from sankhara nirodha, which of course is nibbana, which is complete absence of sankharas, but here it's like a continual intention. So this, of course, if you're familiar with Ajahn Brahm's teaching on jhanas, this is what Ajahn Brahm talks about, the nature of chetana or intention in samadhi attainments, that it's like a continuation of that sankhara which has been, which you had before or in the beginning stages of meditation, but that's not actually working in the meditation itself as such. It's just a residue, sankhara vasesa.
So is the Buddha saying that it's impossible to achieve such a state if you've got that sankhara vasesa, or is he saying the other type of sankhara?
That's right, the other type of sankhara, yeah? If you have the sankhara regarding what's seen, heard, sensed and cognized, then that's a disaster, because the basis of neither perception nor non-perception is only attained with a residue of your former sankhara.
So what means that once you are already in this meditation process, you're already in the momentum of going towards it, so that's right.
That's right, yes, you have that direction, so you're not thinking about it at that time, but you're just following the course that was already set beforehand. Yeah. See, that's how that's how in meditation you keep your focus, but you're not always thinking, I'm keeping my focus. Yeah, but you're sort of going in that direction. Yeah.
So you try to jump in between different jhanas?
Well, the text doesn't say that here. This text is only talking about the neither perception nor non-perception, so be a bit cautious about how much we infer from it. Yeah. But then that could also be a sankhara vasesa. Yeah, you make the previous determination. I'm going to determine these. The word determination is also sankhara, so you can make a previous determination. I'm going to get into this and then that and then the other, and I'm going to pop up and down and bob around and around. Don't know why you want to, but if you do, then you can do that. Yeah. According to the suttas, yeah. According to the suttas, although in the commentaries they talk about skipping jhanas and skipping the order of jhanas and things like that, yeah, but the suttas always present them in sequence. Yeah. Okay, and then the last one. Oh, sorry. Not the last one. The next one is the annihilationists. Now, then the next one is those recluse Brahmins who describe the annihilation, destruction, and extermination of an existing being at death. Okay, sato satasa. Okay, so this means that there basically is a self here, and that self is going to be annihilated at death, which of course is quite distinct from the Buddhist point of view, which is that there isn't anybody anyway, so nothing to be annihilated. And they criticize all of those ones beforehand, and there's a very lovely criticism here that I'm not sure I haven't met elsewhere. And they say all those they criticize those others, saying that all these good recluses and Brahmins rushing onwards assert their attachment thus: we shall be thus after death, we shall be thus after death, just as a merchant going to market thinks, through this that will be mine, with this I can get that. So too these good recluses and Brahmins sing like merchants when they declare, we shall be thus after death, we shall be thus after death. It's fairly telling criticism, isn't it? Yeah, and there's this kind of spiritual materialistic idea that's very common in Buddhism as well. Yeah, you make a kind of investment, and it's very much like that. Yeah, you come along and make an offering. I'm going to get this back after death. Yeah, and so it's this point is that you're always kind of. You're not living. That's the basic criticism. It's here we are now. This is our life. We're here. You know, why are we living this life in the expectation of some future life which we don't even really know about? Yeah, and we never actually enjoy ourselves now. Yeah, this is that criticism, and a fairly telling criticism. So the Tathagata bhikkhus understands this thus. Those good recluses and Brahmins who describe the annihilation, destruction, and extermination of an existing being at death through fear of identity and disgust with identity. So the word identity is the attachment to a self. They keep running and circling around that same identity. Okay? And so you keep on, the very fact that you're disgusted with it, you're trying to push it away, means you're still attached to it. You're not letting go of it. You're trying to get rid of it. Just as a dog bound by a leash, of course the leash being the attachment to a firm post or pillar, keeps on running and running, circling around that same post and pillar. Yeah? So you can imagine the more you run around it, the more you tie yourself closer to it. So too, these good recluses and Brahmins, through fear of identity and disgust with identity, keep running and circling around that same identity. This is conditioned and gross, but there is the cessation of formations. Having known there is this, seeing the escape from that, the Tathagata has gone beyond that. Okay, so here's the idea that rejecting and pushing away the self is not the same thing as the cessation of attachment for the self. Okay, so there's not like this, neither running after it, nor trying to push it away. And if you compare that simile, the merchant simile is compared with the simile that Sariputta gives about his expectations of his death. He said like a workman that's waiting for his wages. Yeah. So rather than a businessman who's always going and investing and trying to get more, he's just like a workman. He's already done his work and he just waits. He's neither rushing or trying to do anything about it. Yeah. He knows that Friday's going to come. I'm going to get my wages. So there's nothing I can do about it. Yeah. So that's the difference.
So that's like taking over
the truth. What's like? Vibhava tanha, exactly. Vibhava tanha, exactly. So this is a vibhava tanha, is the annihilationist tendency. Okay. Now then, the summary here. Because any recluses or Brahmins who speculate about the future and hold views about the future, who assert various doctrinal propositions concerning the future, all assert these five bases, or a certain one among them. And of course, the problem being that we haven't actually discussed the five. So we've had the five mentioned at the beginning, which is that the self is unimpaired and percipient, non-percipient, or neither percipient nor non-percipient. And then the fact that the self will be annihilated, that's the four. And the fifth one was the view of Nibbana here and now. And we haven't discussed Nibbana here and now, right? And yet the text says we've all five. Whoops. Right? So obviously there's been some textual problem. The commentary tries to explain it away. All that tells us is that the text has the same problems in the commentarial time and that they actually did recognize the problem. But it doesn't tell us what actually the situation is. Now I might just skip from here, and we've done the speculations about the future, and I might just come from here to Venerable Anālaya's essay, and we can now have a look at that, and that might help us to understand some of these problems that we've encountered. Okay, so. The Panchatthaya has, as I mentioned before, a complete parallel in Tibetan and various Sanskrit fragments and some comparable ideas found in the Brahmajala Sutta and Chinese and Tibetan counterparts. Actually, the Brahmajala and its Chinese counterpart in the Dharmaguptaka, the Virga Agama, are extremely similar. And there's a detailed comparative study of that available online, which is a good one to read. So the scholars believe that the Sanskrit fragments are also from Sarvastivada or Mula Sarvastivada, and also probably from the Dirgha Agama rather than the Majjhima as in the Pali collection. Okay, the Panchatthaya and its Tibetan parallel begin by distinguishing between five and three types of views. The five views assert that a after self, after death, the self is percipient, and so on. So these are similar in the Pali and Tibetan forms. The five and three presentation in this way provides two complementary perspectives on these views. The first of these perspectives singles out five main modes of asserting a self. The second perspective then takes up the same five types from the perspective of three different time periods, distinguishing between views concerned with what would happen after death, at death, or before death. Okay, so that one's after death, being the sanyi, at death being the annihilationist one, and before death being the nibbana, here and now. The Panchatthaya Sutta takes up the first of the five types of view concerned with the self that is percipient after death by listing together eight variations of such a self. The Tibetan counterpart does not treat two of these eight variations, as it does not mention the material and immaterial self and the neither material nor immaterial self. Brahmajala Sutta and its Chinese and Tibetan counterparts agree in this respect with the Pali version, as they all include a percipient self that is material and immaterial, and a percipient self that is neither material nor immaterial. Okay, so one difference here is that the Pali version, the Tibetan, doesn't have aroga in all of the different kinds of self. Okay, so this comes back to that discussion that we had earlier, whether there seems to be a bit of an ambiguity here, whether it's talking about just an ordinary everyday self that might survive from anybody, in which case to describe it as aroga would seem to be inappropriate. Or does it mean the self which is attained through spiritual practice and is a goal of spiritual practice, which would justify the use of the word aroga? Okay, so in addition to the kinds of percipient self found in the Pali, the Tibetan version adds the possibility that a percipient self after death has become great, mahagata, of course in the suttas, immeasurable, apamana, and become great, mahagata, often function as near synonyms. As both versions describe views on a percipient self by working through pairs of opposites, once the contrast with the limited self has been provided by the immeasurable type of self, it would seem redundant to additionally bring in a self that has become great. The Pali, you find this kind of ambiguity all the way through the text in these kinds of things. These words, apamana and mahagata, are found, for example, in the list of the kinds of citta in the third of the four satipatthanas. And again, you find these kinds of ambiguities constantly through the different versions, but they basically mean the same thing. There's no particular doctrinal significance to that. Pali version's list of percipient selves next mentions the consciousness kasina. The Tibetan version, it speaks instead of the consciousness sphere, ayatana. According to the Pali commentary, the reference to the consciousness kasina in the present context indeed intends the sphere of consciousness. As both versions next turn to the sphere of nothingness, which they qualify as supreme among perceptions, the Tibetan use of sphere, ayatana, in relation to consciousness is more in conformity with the remainder of the discourse than the Pali version's reference to the consciousness kasina, 17. The Sanskrit fragment it has down here has been reconstructed as vijñānandhyāyatana, which is the base of infinite consciousness. But there's also another Sanskrit quote found in this version of the Sangiti Sutta, vijñānandhyāyatana kṛtsna. Kṛtsna here being the kasina. This is the Sanskrit spelling of kasina. And again, showing the identity between these things, ayatana and kasina, essentially meaning the same thing in this context. Okay, so Analia has a bit more of a discussion down below. According to the Netipakarana, later book on textual interpretation in Pali, the space kasina and consciousness kasina should be reckoned as to belong to the realm of insight or vipassana, while the other eight kasinas should be understood as samatha meditation objects. So again here, the neti is showing this tendency which you find throughout the Pali tradition to gradually take things which originally belonged to samatha, the space and consciousness kasinas, and to interpret them as if they were meaning vipassana practice, which obviously they're not. coming back to the main discussion, Pali and Tibetan versions of the Panchatraya Sutta agree that the Suttagata has understood the conditioned nature of these postulations of a percipient self after death and has gone beyond them. While the Tibetan version of the Panchatraya Sutta treats the next kind of view on a self that is not percipient after death as a single view, the Pali version has the same view in a fourfold mode, as we've already seen. Brahmajala and its Chinese and Tibetan counterparts take their analysis even further as they present views about a non-percipient self in eight variations, additionally taking up the four possibilities that such a self could be limited, unlimited, both or neither. The same difference recurs in the treatment of a self that is neither percipient nor non-percipient, which the Tibetan version of the Panchatraya Sutta treats as a single proposal, while the Pali version offers a fourfold presentation, and in the various versions of the Brahmajala Sutta we have eight variations. The Pali and Tibetan versions of the Panchatraya Sutta agree on confronting those who propose a percipient self after death with the criticism that perception is a disease, and those who uphold a non-percipient self after death with the criticism that the absence of perception is a state of delusion. The two versions also agree in indicating that it's impossible for consciousness to arise apart from the other aggregates, a point also made in the Sanskrit version. So in all of those cases, essentially it's identical in the different version, the only differences essentially being that the difference is in the elaboration of the numbers of kinds of alternatives in the kinds of self, but the basic discussion is the same in all of the versions. The Pali Panchatraya Sutta next takes up the belief that the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception can be attained through what is seen, heard, sensed and cognized, explaining that this type of attainment can only be entered with a mere residue of formations. This is the Sankhara Vasesa. The implications of this passage are less clear in the Tibetan version, which in addition to what is seen, heard, sensed and cognized, also brings in such topics as morality and discipline, sila and vata, celibacy, brahmacharya, and ascetic practices, tapas. Okay, so this brings to mind some passages in the Sutta Nipata, which in a somewhat similar vein associate what is seen, heard and sensed with morality and observances. So these passages found mainly in the Parayana Vagga of the Sutta Nipata. And I agree with Analia, I think that most likely this has been influenced by those passages and being a somewhat of a confusion of the text. The Tibetan version presents the attainment of neither perception nor non-perception as the pinnacle of existence. Though the Pali version does not make this point, a Pali discourse in the Anguttara Nikaya similarly classifies the realm corresponding to the attainment of neither perception nor non-perception as the pinnacle of existence, bhavagara. Okay? So those devas who've been reborn in the base of neither perception nor non-perception, this is said to be the peak of existences. And notice the word bhava is in a plural form here. Yeah. So this relates to a question which is sometimes debated about what's the best way of translating bhava. So here it's obviously talking about the place that these devas are reborn in and saying this is the best of existences, the best of bhavas. Sometimes bhava is translated as being, sometimes translated as becoming, but of course you can't have those words in plural. You can't have beings, not in this kind of sense. You can't have becomings. Okay, so it must mean existence. It's the only grammatical way of translating it. The Panchatraya Sutta next turns to annihilationism. While the Pali version treats annihilationism as a single proposal, the Tibetan version offers a more detailed presentation as it distinguishes between seven possible instances of this view. So now the Tibetan is more detailed, whereas previously the Pali was more detailed. The Brahmajala and its Chinese and Tibetan parallels similarly treat seven variations of annihilationism, thereby supporting the presentation given in the Tibetan version. In both, which doesn't necessarily mean it's more authentic, it could also be the case that the Tibetan version was expanded using materials from the Brahmajala. In both versions of the Panchatthaya Sutta, the annihilationists employ the imagery of a merchant in their criticism of the various proposals of a self that survives after death. Both versions also reveal that the fear of personality of the annihilationist is his very bondage, a predicament the Pali version additionally illustrates with the imagery of a dog moving in circles around a post to which it is bound. So this is, in other words, these very, very striking images are found in both versions. So that's the as far as we've reached with the text so far, and we've done the views relating to the future, and essentially the text is basically identical in the Tibetan and Pali versions, with the sole exception of those few differences in the elaboration of the views. Anyway, so now move to the speculations about the past. And we don't need to look at all of these in detail. Some assert that the self and the world are eternal. Only this is true, anything else is false. Some assert that the self and the world are not eternal, or both eternal and not eternal, or neither eternal nor not eternal. And this is true, anything else is wrong. The self and the world are finite, infinite, both finite and infinite, or neither finite nor infinite. The self and the world are percipient of unity, percipient of diversity, percipient of limited, percipient of the immeasurable, in the same group of four we've had previously. The self and the world experience exclusively pleasure, or exclusively pain, or both pleasure and pain, or neither pleasure nor pain. Okay, so similar list is found in the Brahmajala once more. Now, one of the a few points that need mentioning in this kind of formulation. First of them is the identification of the self and the world, attacha lokocha. The self and the world are eternal. So this is a kind of characteristic of the Indian thought, is that the self and the world, the individual little bit here and the big cosmos, are in some way very closely interconnected. Now, that's conceived in different ways by different philosophers, but the basic idea is very similar. And so here the idea that the self and the world are eternal is almost certainly referring to this Brahmanical idea of the identity between the little self and the big Brahman, who is the cosmic self. Okay, this is really what it's talking about here. The individual self and the cosmic self are eternal. And the other point that's worth making about all of these is that the kind of the dogmatic assertion which is followed, idameva satyam moghamanyam. Okay, so you're making a dogmatic insistence about these metaphysical assertions. Okay, so this is a theme which is then taken up in the next paragraph, where the Buddha returns to the theme which we've seen again and again in the various suttas, and we've seen this in many of the suttas in the Brahmana Vagga we've been looking at, where the Buddha's criticizing the Brahmins because they're making claims of certainty, but they don't really have the evidence or the reason to back up those claims. And indeed, we find the same set of means of knowledge, the pramanas, which we found many times in the Brahmana Vagga. Therein, because as to those recluses and Brahmins who hold such a doctrine and view as this, the self and the world are eternal, only this is true, anything else is wrong, that apart from faith, apart from approval, ruchi, apart from oral tradition, apart from reasoned cogitation, apart from reflective acceptance of a view that they will have any pure and clear personal knowledge of this, that is impossible. Okay? So, coming back to, and I'm sure we're all by now all familiar with this set of dhammas. And so the Buddha's making the point here that that these assertions that the self is eternal, right? It's not something that you can actually know yourself. You can't actually have a pure and clear personal knowledge of eternity. That's not how consciousness works. Consciousness actually just perceives time. Consciousness is conditioned. It perceives changes in time. Consciousness can't, by its very nature, perceive eternity. So if you're talking about myself is eternal, you're doing it actually. You're based on some kind of faith, some kind of approval, an oral tradition, and so on. And that's informed your interpretation. You may well have a personal experience, right? It's not saying that these people don't have any personal experience. It's just saying that they've interpreted that personal experience because of the beliefs and the conditioning that they've had from their faith and learning and whatever. Since they have no pure and clear personal knowledge, because they can't actually see it directly themselves, then even the mere fragmentary knowledge that those good recluses and Brahmins clarify about their view is declared to be clinging on their part. That is conditioned and gross, but there is the cessation of formations. Okay, so this is kind of attachment. And then it goes and repeats that same criticism with regard to all of those other forms of views. And again, we won't go through them in detail. Now we then come to another section which Bhikkhu Bodhi in his translation has provisionally labelled Nibbana here and now, and suggesting that perhaps this was the original Nibbana here and now which was supposed to be discussed in the first section. We'll come back to that in a little while. But to the view itself here, because some recluse or Brahman with the relinquishing of views about the past and the future and through complete lack of resolve upon the fetters of sensual pleasure enters upon and abides in the rapture of seclusion, of course being the first jhana. He thinks this is the peaceful, this is the sublime that I enter upon and abide in the rapture of seclusion. That rapture of seclusion ceases in him. When the cessation of the rapture of seclusion, grief arises. With the cessation of grief, the rapture of seclusion arises. Just as the sunlight pervades the area that the shadow leaves and the shadow pervades the area that the sunlight leaves, so too with the cessation of the rapture of seclusion, grief arises, and with the cessation of grief, the rapture of seclusion arises. So he's talking about a meditative process, somebody's getting into first jhana, and who not only, you notice that in the way that this is normally, the jhanas are normally presented in Buddhism, it just presents you get into that attainment. Right? But here it says you get into it and then you think about it. Ah, this is that. Yeah. So it's that reflecting afterwards, which is the thing here. This is where you're getting attached to it. Ah, this is it. I've got it. Right? This is peaceful. This is sublime. In other words, this is the goal that I've been looking for. So then when you've got, because of that attachment, then when the meditation attainment ceases, then you have sorrow. Yeah. And this is what's called Niramisa Domanasa. And which is referred to in the Satipatthana Sutta. The Niramisa Domanasa is the longing for the attainments which you don't have. So you lose that meditation attainment and then you have sorrow. But notice that the sorrow is, it's not criticizing the attainment as such, yeah, but it's criticizing the attachment to it by thinking that this attainment is my spiritual goal. The Tathagata understands this is conditioned and gross, but there is a cessation of formations, and seeing the escape from it, the Tathagata has gone beyond that. Now, next page is missing from the online version. Here, because some recluse or Brahman with the relinquishing of views about the past and future, with a lack of resolve upon that is of sensual pleasure, and with surmounting of the rapture of seclusion, okay, so surmounting first jhana, enters upon and abides in unworldly pleasure. Okay? And this is Niramisa Sukha. This is the pleasure of the third jhana. Could possibly be maybe its second jhana as well, but certainly third jhana. He thinks this is peaceful, this is sublime, that I've entered upon it. In other words, he gets attached to that third jhana. Then, again, similarly, when he loses the attainment, then displeasure or grief arises. Similarly, surmounting the rapture of seclusion, he enters upon and abides in the neither pleasant, painful nor pleasant feeling, of course being the fourth jhana. This is the peaceful, this is sublime. And then the fourth jhana leaves him and he feels grief arising. So, again, there is the escape from that. So here, because some reclusive Brahman, with the relinquishing of views about the past and future and so on, with surmounting of all those other things, regards himself thus, I am at peace, I have attained Nibbana, I am without clinging. So again, there's the attachment and the notion of a self which is coming in there. Yet this good Brahman still clings, good Samana or Brahman still clings, clinging to either a view about the past or a view about the future or to a fetter of sensual pleasure or to the rapture of seclusion or to unworldly pleasure or to neither painful nor pleasant feeling. And when this venerable one regards himself thus, I am at peace, I have attained Nibbana, I am without clinging, that too is declared to be clinging on the part of this good recluse or Brahman. That is conditioned and gross, but there is the cessation of formations. Having understood there is this and seeing the effect from it, the Tathagata has gone beyond that. So, just to have a look at that phrase. Here's the actual phrase, I am peaceful, I have Nibbana, I am without clinging. So notice the phrasing all ends with the hamasmi, santo hamasmi, I am, nibuto hamasmi, anupadano hamasmi, I am peaceful, I am santa, I am nibuto, I have attained nibbana, I am anupada, I am without grasping, and then ahamasmi. So of course ahamasmi is this very pregnant term. It's not just that, this is why Bhikkhu Bodhi had to emphasize it in the Pali translation. It's not just the ordinary way that you say, I have this thing, but it's an emphatic term. Actually, in Pali, you can normally say that. Okay, so you can normally say, Santo Asmi, Asmi being the verb form, I am, okay? And the notion of a self is implicit in that. Okay? So when you're speaking the first person or second person or third person in Pali, the verb itself makes that clear. Now when you include ahamasmi, then that's an emphasis, right? It's not just the ordinary everyday language that you'd use, it's a special emphasis. I have attained. Okay? And this is what you always find right throughout the Brahmanical scriptures in this idea of ahamasmi, I am, it's emphasized, I am, this is myself, this is what I am. And ahamasmi is one of the most characteristic phrases of the whole Brahmanical tradition. This is said to be the very first words that Manu, the first man, uttered when he was created, ahamasmi, I am. Yeah? So this is the most fundamental assertion. Or again, you have the parallel phrase, very famous from the Brihadaranyaka. Tadvanasi is the exactly the same phrase. Thou art that, usually translated. You translate it like that. That's exactly the same phrase. Tam ahamasmi, that's just in the second person. Okay. So, in other words, these kinds of what Bhikkhu Bodhi is called Nibbana here and now are the attachment to the jhanas and this idea of non clinging, and the attachment to this idea of oneself as being without clinging and so on. Because this supreme state of sublime peace has been discovered by the Tathagata, that is to say, liberation through not clinging. By understanding as they actually are, the origination, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and the escape, in the case of the six spheres of contact. Because that is the supreme state of sublime peace discovered by the Tathagata, that is the liberation through not clinging and understanding the six bases of contact. So again, as in the Brahmajala Sutta, it ends by claiming that the understanding of the six sense spheres is the ending of all of these views. And so of course, this is once again emphasizing that return to understanding in terms of direct experience, rather than the reliance on the oral tradition and faith and texts and so on, which was criticized earlier. you're actually talking about what's actually knowable is the six senses, right? Rather than the speculations about metaphysical selves and eternal selves and all of these kinds of things. It's actually the realization of the experience as it happens. And the origination, disappearance, gratification, danger and escape, of course, the five kinds of contemplation that we find many times throughout the suttas. So just return to Venerable Anālaya's discussion here. Okay, after treating the 16 types of views relating to the past, Panchatthaya Sutta and its Tibetan parallel take up attachment to the jhanas and misconceptions of having attained nibbana. Views in relation to the jhanas now make up 4 out of 5 views of nibbana in the present life in Brahmajala Sutta and its Chinese and Tibetan parallels. The same heading would all the more fit into the second notions of nibbana, the last item examined in the 2 versions of the Panchatthaya Sutta. This suggests that the treatment of the jhanas and nibbana notions found now at the end of the Panchatthaya Sutta indeed corresponds to the 5th of the type of views pronounced in the introduction to both discourses to views on nibbana in the present life. So this suggestion is confirmed in the Tibetan version and Sanskrit fragments, both of which agree on explicitly introducing this section as an examination of views on nibbana in the present life. Okay, so that's, in other words, supporting this identification which Bhikkhu Bodhi made, saying that this last section is nibbana in the present life. However, a problem with the identification is that the Pali and Tibetan versions indicate that such attachment to the jhanas, a mistaken notion about nibbana, takes place after views about past and future have been relinquished. How could views on nibbana in the present life, treated in the Panchatthaya Sutta introductory section as types of view relating to the future, correspond to what both versions of the present passages introduce as something based on having to overcome views about the future? The solution to this problem could perhaps be found in a rather minor change in terminology found in both versions of the Panchatthaya Sutta. When treating the 5 and 3 modes of views, the Pali and Tibetan versions speak of views and thoughts in relation to the future. Okay, so views and thoughts relation to the future. Aparanta kapika. Okay, so here we have the kapika as the thoughts. Okay. Okay, so the thoughts and views about the future. Now, though one could think that views and thoughts are simply used as near equivalents, the absence of a reference to thoughts in the present passage could perhaps be taken to indicate that whereas the first 4 modes of a percipient self, a non-percipient self, a self that is neither percipient nor non-percipient, and a self that will be annihilated, can be reckoned as full-fledged views, when it comes to nibbana in the present life, the 2 versions of the Panchatthaya Sutta no longer reckon this as a full-fledged instances of views, but only as thoughts or ways of reasoning concerned with the future. On this assumption, the observed problem could be resolved, since though at the present junction of events, views in relation to the future have already been overcome, the same may not be yet the case for thoughts about the future. So, perhaps a bit tenuous, but anyway, to assume that nibbana in the present life should indeed be the sign of the future finds also support in the Brahmajala Sutta and its Chinese and Tibetan parallels, all of which place their examination of views on nibbana in the present life under the category of thoughts and views relating to the future. The sequence of the treatment found in the Brahmajala Sutta and its Chinese and Tibetan parallels, moreover, suggests that a treatment of views about the past should precede views about the future, making sense. Taking a lead from the Brahmajala Sutta sequence, perhaps the section on views about the past in the Panchatthaya Sutta should precede the entire exposition of views about the future. If the section on views about the past should, during the course of oral transmission, have become accidentally shifted to the wrong place in the discourse, and at an earlier time should have stood right at the beginning of the discourse, most of the problems noted so far could be resolved. This would, however, implied that the statement on the 5 and 3 was not an introduction to the discourse as a whole, but only to its treatment of views and thoughts related to the future. This indeed is the case in the Pali version, which specifies the 5 and 3 to be concerned with the future. While the general treatment of views in the 2 Panchatthaya Suttas is relatively similar to the Brahmajala Sutta and its parallels, the analysis of views about the future into 5 and 3 is the peculiarity of the present discourse, which has led to the title in the Pali and Tibetan versions. Sanskrit fragments suggest, however, that the present discourse may also have been known under a different title. 49. didn't have the actual title there. Discourse titles can at times be the outcome of later developments. The title 5 and 3 could have come into being after the analysis into 5 and 3 has come to the beginning part of the discourse through an accidental shift of the section of past views to a later part of the discourse. In sum, according to my hypothetical reconstruction of the sequence of the discourse, the Panchatayo Sutta's treatment should begin with an examination of various views about the past. Next, views about the future come in their place. An examination introduced by analysing them into 5 and 3 without, however, identifying this analysis to be a summary of the whole discourse. After this examination has treated views on a self surviving after death and annihilationist views, the discourse should then continue by examining the jhanas and the statement notion of nibbana, thereby covering the item mentioned as 5th among the 5 and 3, which is nibbana in the present life. And then after that, the concluding statement for this exposition and the conclusion for the sutta as a whole. So, in other words, Venerable Analio suggests that what's now the middle section, which is the speculations about the past, should really be the first section, and the speculations about the future should end with the Nibbana here and now, which is, I think, a very reasonable suggestion. Okay, so it then goes on. So we don't need to have a look at all of that in detail, but there's just a discussion about the various presentations of the 16 views about the past. Both of them have the statement that the ideas about the past are not the outcome of personal realization, but depend on faith, liking, oral tradition, reasoning, or acceptance of a view. And in both cases, the analysis of jhana is similar, the unworldly pleasure and bliss of seclusion and neutral feelings. According to the Pali commentary, the bliss of seclusion stands for the first and second jhana, unworldly pleasure for the third jhana, and neutral feelings for the fourth jhana. Pali and Tibetan discourses highlight the problem that arises due to the fact that such experiences are not permanent and will cease, at which point they'll be replaced by a coarser state of mind. Both of them have the simile of the alteration between the sunshine and the shadow. However, while the Pali version continues to use the same imagery, the Tibetan discourse offers different similes for the other two cases. Thus, it compares the fluctuation between unworldly pleasure and the bliss of seclusion to the fluctuations of water, which arises and diminishes, and the shift from neutral feelings to unworldly pleasure to a stick thrown up in space, which may fall on its side or on its tip. The two versions next examine the case of a recluse Brahmin who assumes to have attained Nibbana. According to both versions, this recluse believes himself to be free from attachment, to which the Tibetan version adds that he claims to be without craving, which is also found in the Sanskrit version. The Tibetan version, moreover, indicates that this recluse thinks he no longer has the self that he has earlier. This last is noteworthy since it reveals a thorough misunderstanding by this recluse. Such a misunderstanding will be impossible for a disciple in higher training, a seka, who by dint of his personal experience and stream entry would know only too well that there's never been any self in the first place. In this way, the Tibetan version makes it clear why this recluse's claim to have reached realization can be dismissed as thoroughly mistaken. In the Pali version, the problem with this recluse seems rather to be his self-centeredness inherent in his claim formulated as, I have attained peace, I have attained Nibbana. The commentary says this is conceit. Thus, whereas the Tibetan version, it's clear the claim to attain Nibbana is made by a worldling, the same is not the case in the Pali version, since the same claim could also be made by a disciple in higher training through overestimation of the level of his or her progress on the path. Conceit, after all, is only abandoned during the progression from non-return to full awakening. So this is a difference which Analio is pointing out there. I don't really agree with that. I don't think that a I don't think that a stream enterer could get attached to those attainments in that same way. My understanding would be that a stream enterer could have a like an emotional or an intuitive attachment to those states or to his attainment, but couldn't have a reflective attachment to them. Okay, so once they might kind of intuitively grasp for it, or just, you know, their mind sort of goes for it, but as soon as they think about it, then they realize, actually, oh no, hang on, this is foolish, I don't have a self. And of course, in that context, the person is obviously reflecting about it, they're thinking about it, yeah? It's not just a kind of an intuitive or instinctive a liking of that experience, but it's actually a reflective view about it. And personally, I don't think that a stream mentor could have that kind of reflective view about a self. Okay, so that's about all the important statements in Mario's essay there. So it's a bit of a difficult sort of for this week, and certainly a contrasting mood from many of the more straightforward discourses in the Brahmanavagga that we've been looking at. And it's a great shame, I think it's a great shame that the very important Dhammas in this particular text are a bit confused by the textual tradition, but nevertheless the main message still gets through. So are there any more questions on that one before we wrap up for this afternoon? Okay. So this week, Majjhima 103, Kinti Sutta. Now let's finish by paying respects.
Thank you.